was that because remember how the Templars had sort of like found refuge in Spain and Portugal?
Okay.
That they had hid it there in Catalonia, and that they had also been given a generous gift to their master there, Arnold of Troya.
Arnold of Palma. What? He was half Templar, half Muslim. over ice.
Welcome back to the Trilateral Troika. This is Steve, along with the other Steve.
Ah.
And Ryan.
No alcohol tonight, man. It's ginger beer. Just ginger beer.
Hey, if you drink enough of it... Well, no, actually, it won't do anything, but...
It will not do
shit. Some smoking banana peel stuff.
Oh, God. Ew, bro. You just gave me flashback to middle school.
Middle school? Yeah. God damn.
Yeah, bro. Shout out to Alex and Dustin. We try to smoke banana peels.
I heard that when you do it, you turn into an ape. And that's why there was the Planet of the Apes.
I can confirm nothing happens. It just tastes like shit.
I think are your it's sons a certain banana.
Are your children smoking banana peels? Look for the signs. Are they texting each other? We're going Magilla tonight. Could mean that they are smoking banana peels.
It's 2:40 p.m. Do you know where your middle school students are?
I'm throwing barrels. That means they are getting high off the banana peels.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. The dumb shit we believed as kids is just unreal.
Yep. Yep.
And speaking of the dumb shit that I believe...
Let's talk about believers.
So today, guys, as Ryan mentioned, this is our part two of our two-part series on the Knights Templar. We're going to be talking about Templar conspiracy theories. And
let's go!
It's Templar, let's ride.
I just play the air horn, depending on which recording we go with here. You may or may not hear the sounds.
Oh, that's so awesome. I feel like I'm on, like, morning talk radio, like MJ and BJ in the morning and shit like that, where they just have, like,
welcome those random sound plays in the back. MJ and BJ here on The Rock.
98.7 The Rock.
Did you guys remember them?
No.
No, I would say the ones I remember the most who are still around, I think, still, I don't think, is the Monsters in the Morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember them. MJ and BJ were, like, out of Tampa, and they specialized in, like, prank radio phone calls with, like, the crotchety old man voice. And I mean, like, the last time I think I heard them, I was probably 17, and it was, like, the funniest fucking thing I had ever heard in my life up until that point. So I'm sure it wouldn't age as well as I'm thinking, but they were, like, the morning shock jocks kind of nonsense that was popular in, like, the late 90s.
Were they in the Knights Templar?
They were.
Okay. I just wanted to know.
Third degree.
Oh, wow.
They used to prank call the Pope.
That's why they all got, That's why they all got burned at the stake. They sent the Pope one too many prank phone calls and.
Ciao, io sono il Papa. No, I didn't order any pizza.
They left a flaming bag of like dog poop outside the Vatican and. Got his fancy like Pope shoes all messed up.
Oh no, il mio Pope. Scarpe di popo covered in de poo-poo.
So with the Knights Templar, there's always been...
What was that pause? Did you guys want me to do more with that joke? Or
I was plugging in my headset because I got a warning that the battery was low.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
I was just going to let you riff for a bit, you know? And then I would rain
things
in.
You know, the funny thing about the Pope is...
Let Steve do his crowd work, and then...
So where's everybody from, huh? Detroit!
Sheboygan! I didn't say Sheboygan, so you're from Sheboygan. That's a funny name.
Hey, buddy, nobody said your boy.
Listen, nobody will ever do crowd work as well as Stavros. He's just... He's pretty good. He's the GOAT, man.
I don't know if he's the best, but since I don't have another name right now off the top of my head, he's pretty good.
His laugh, well, I think. Like, his laugh kills it.
Every fucking other thing he says. What'd you say? You're from Philadelphia? And you're just like, holy shit,
Philadelphia?
Dude.
Philadelphia?
I actually told Steve when I first started listening to Gumtown, I told him, I'm like, I can't stand this fucking guy's laugh. I have to turn the show off. Because it's like 90% of the show. It did grow on me. Yeah, that's true.
With the Knights Templar, there's often theories about their wealth and also what type of items they could have possessed. Usually fixated on the legendary Holy Grail.
It's like it's a fucking RPG or something. What kind of items did they have?
What's on their loot chart?
The one guy, he's carrying like 6 swords, 2 knives, 35 potions. Are you kidding me?
Where you got all that, man?
And also the Ark of the Covenant.
Isn't that from Indiana Jones?
Yeah, it's the Ark. Yes. Moses stored the
also tablets. also from the famous literary work, the Bible.
Oh, yeah, you know.
Oh, you mean the Holy Bibli. Yeah. I gotta go listen to some Eddie Izzard. Oh, the Holy Bibli.
This largely stems from the fact that their headquarters was on the Temple Mount, as discussed previously, mm-hmm. And that they had held that space for about 75 years.
Huh.
Oh. So there are various sort of legends about what treasure they had. That they had managed to hide from the sort of wrath that came down on them from King Philip, and what happened to it, you know, after the fall of the Templars. There was also, for instance, in René Le Château in France, there was a treasure allegedly was found there in the 19th century, and one speculative source claimed that the treasure had been a long lost treasure of the Templars.
What was the treasure?
Just like a large amount of like gold that was found, just sort of like a.
Was there anything to back that up? Like was it like a stash maybe? Like, you know, like El Chapo or something?
Yeah.
No, that's not what I asked. I said, was there anything to? I said, was there anything to back it up?
Well, no, because it's just speculative. They're just saying, like, oh, where could it be from? And the guy's like, oh, well, maybe it was from the Templars.
It's those sneaky Templars again.
In 1910, there was a publication by Joaquin Mira y Sanz, he made the case that the Knights Templar hid and buried a lot of treasure in Vrana, Zadar County, because it was near because he was from just the general theory was that because remember how the Templars had sort of like found refuge in Spain and Portugal,
okay,
that they had hid it there in Catalonia, and that they had also been given a generous gift to their master Arnold of Troya.
Arnold of Palmer. What? He was half Templar, half Muslim over ice.
The author Hugh J. Schoenfield argued in 1984 that the Knights Templar may have found the copper scroll treasure of the Qumran Essenes in a tunnel beneath the Temple Mount.
Yeah, the Qumran.
Who were a...
the original Qumers.
The originals, the OGs.
Yeah, the Qumers.
The original ultra-Orthodox tunneling Jews, the Essenes.
Yeah, they wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes. He suggested that this might explain one of the charges of heresy that was later brought upon them by the Inquisition. Because they were sort of reading this like alternate version of books of the Old Testament.
So, no cap, I used to think heresy and hearsay were the same thing, and people were just saying the word two different ways when I was a little kid.
Because I went to Catholic school, I never understood why people said hearsay the way they did. I always thought it was heresy.
Exactly. You should get it mixed up.
Uh-huh.
You're always being accused of it.
People are like, that's just hearsay. I'm like,
the shit I used to say in Catholic school, I definitely committed some medieval heresy, at least.
Bro, them nuns would have fucking chokeslammed me if they actually know what I was thinking and doing.
There's this story of me, my mom taking me to church when I was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old. And I kept asking her if this was Jesus' house. And then she would go, yes. And I kept asking her the same thing, and I was just sitting there. And then while the priest is giving the homily, I was just like, well, when's he coming out? And I did it, like, really loud. She was super embarrassed. But, yeah, that's heresy number one. They would have killed me in the Templars, you know?
So what you're saying is that as a child, you would have been super jazzed to see the Jesus guy from the Holy Land Experience, the guy who played Jesus.
Absolutely. If he just, like, jumped out, I'd be way more into what was going on there. Not just started some doing, like, vaguely Polish man telling me about the gospel.
Just came out and started doing some crowd work. You know, he had his handler. You're like, Jesus is very tired. He can only sign autographs for about 5 minutes. And then he's got to go back to heaven.
You ask Jesus if he needs a pen, he just starts bleeding on his hand just spontaneously. And he's just like, no.
You know, when I came here, there weren't enough headshots for everybody. But through my own miracle, there are enough headshots for everybody here now.
Were you there when he did the miracle of the headshots for autographs?
The most notable monograph talking about sort of the secrets of the Templars is the work Holy Blood and Holy Grail by Michael Bagent, Richard Ley, and Henry Lincoln.
I love that book. It's all based on a false premise, but it's so good.
Have you actually read it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they posit the existence of a secret society known as the Priory of Sion, which was supposed to have a long history starting in 1099, and had a number of well-known grand masters, including Leonardo da Vinci and Isaac Newton.
Yeah, like when Dan Brown was getting all popular, I like looked up the source material and saw that, and it was on Art Bell a couple times. So I bought it, and I still have my copy, but it was interesting when I first read it because it was probably, like, one of the first exposures I had to, like, alternative theories to like, religion and shit, and but it, like, really out there stuff, and then you come to find out that, yeah, well, I don't want to spoil anything, but I don't know if Steve goes that far.
Yeah, I'll go into sort of, like, the source of their sources.
Yeah.
So according to their claims, the Priory of Sion is devoted to restoring the Merovingian dynasty, which ruled the Franks, sort of the first kingdom of France from 457 to 751. They were sort of like the first royal family of Christian France.
Just a bunch of guys named Frank. Hey, Frank, how you doing, Frank? All right, Frank. These guys are real rowdy, these Franks. Jesus.
Is that Frank? Listen, is that you talk about Frankie B or Frankie C? Or you talk about Frank Lynn?
They don't even fight. They just get in an argument about which Frank they're actually referring to.
And this is also ironic because unlike with, say, Anglo-Saxon royal families, the Merovingians never claimed descent from a god. Nor is there evidence that they were regarded as sacred, because oftentimes, you know, by divine right, that kings would consider themselves either anointed by God or have some sort of, if it goes back to a royal family that existed in pagan times, that they were descended from some god or goddess.
You kind of say pagan like you're from Delco Valley, the pagan times.
Priory, though, is said to have created the Knights Templar as its military and financial arm.
Okay.
So mainly what a lot of their research came into their sort of research into this work that they discovered called the Dossier Secrets de Henri Lobineau, the Secret Files of Henri Lobineau, which was supposedly compiled by a Philippe Toscan du Plantier, and it's a 27-page document which was deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France on April 27th, 1967. So it's a book that they found within sort of the National Library of France. Okay. The document purports to represent a part of the history of the Priory of Sion, and it is widely considered to most definitely be a forgery created by a Pierre Plantard and Philippe de Cherisay.
Yeah, it's definitely a forgery.
13 of the 27 pages of the document are taken from another document attributed to a quote-unquote Henri Lobineau, dating from 1964, also thought to have been authored by Plantard, called Genealogy des Rois Merovingiens, or Genealogy of the Merovingian Kings.
Excellent pronunciation.
fuck that one. I mean, like, a good way. Like, you did it.
like in a Larry Black kind of way. Yeah. Or Leon Black kind of way.
Yeah.
Fuck that up, Larry. Fuck that up real good, Larry. The document contains genealogy diagrams, which apparently show Plantard to be a descendant of the Merovingian king Dagobert II.
No, I'm sorry. Dagobert sounds way too much like Star Wars, like Dagobah.
The old Dagobah system.
Yeah.
You know, Dagobert has a Wikipedia article that's longer than some historical figure.
Who you calling a Dagobert, all right? Better not be talking about me.
Steve,
does a Dago bear imply the existence of Dago cubs?
Oh my God.
Dago otters.
Oh no. That's awful.
The Priory of Sion was said to be a fraternal organization founded in France in 1956 by Pierre Plantard in his failed attempts to create a prestigious chivalric order.
I was trying to be a knight. All my life.
Well, because also in Europe, you have these weird, like, sort of, like, monarchist parties and stuff. Yeah. And, like guys who either have real, like, noble claims, but they're, like, their family hasn't, like, held anything in, like, 300 years or more.
Right.
Or guys that just, like, make it up whole cloth and, like, well, actually, you see here, I'm actually the Duke Flambert, and you got to respect that.
Duke, I am Duke Bill Lambert of the, of the Detroit Piston.
In the 1960s, Plantard would begin claiming that his order was the latest front for the secret society founded by the crusading knight Godfrey of Boulogne on Mount Zion in the Kingdom of Jerusalem in 1099. Under the guise of the historical monastic order of the Abbey of Our Lady of Mount Zion.
Hmm.
As a framework for his assertion of being the great monarch prophesied by Nostradamus and a Merovingian pretender, he further claimed that the Priory of Sion was engaged in a centuries-long benevolent conspiracy to install a secret bloodline of the Merovingian dynasty on the thrones of France and the rest of Europe.
Okay.
He eventually, to his surprise, found that all of his claims were fused with the notion of a Jesus bloodline and popularized by the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, whose conclusions would later be borrowed by Dan Brown, as mentioned previously, in his 2003 mystery thriller novel, The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, especially Richard Lee. He kind of looks like Peter Moore, right? Is that the guy that did Watchmen?
Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, yeah.
Yeah.
Looks like Alan Moore and Christopher Lee when he was really old. I mean, he's just like this like sage-looking dude. And there's YouTube clips of him expounding upon it. And you just want to hope that the guy got it right, because it's so interesting, like, to imply that there's a bloodline of Christ. You know? It's like, that's pretty interesting. Nah.
After attracting varying degrees of public attention from the late 1960s to the 1980s, the mystical history of the Priory of Sion was exposed as what is called a ludibrium, an elaborate hoax in the form of an esoteric puzzle created by Plantard as part of his unsuccessful strategy to become becoming a respected, influential, and wealthy player in the French esoterist and monarchist circles.
Crazy.
Okay.
So pieces of evidence presented in support of the historical existence and activities of the Priory of Sion before 1956, such as the so-called aforementioned Dossier Secret de Henri Lobineau, were discovered to have been forged and then planted in various locations around France by Plantard and his accomplices. Despite the quote-unquote Priory of Sion mysteries having been exhaustively debunked by journalists and scholars as France's greatest 20th century literary hoax, many conspiracy theorists still persist in believing that the Priory of Sion was a millennium-old cabal concealing a religiously subversive secret.
Which should tell you everything you need to know about religion.
Right there.
A few independent researchers outside of academia claim, based on alleged insider information, that the Priory of Sion continues to operate as a conspiratorial secret society to this day. Some skeptics express concern that the proliferation and popularity of these pseudo-historical books, websites, and films inspired by the hoax contribute to the problem of unfounded conspiracy theories becoming mainstream, which we can see in full effect here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all contrary to Plantard's initial what could be described as Franco-Israelist claims that the Merovingians were only descended from the tribe of Benjamin. In Holy Blood, Holy Grail, they asserted that the Priory of Sion protects the Merovingian dynasty because they are the literal descendants of the historical Jesus and his alleged wife, Mary Magdalene, traced further back to King David. Which is also something that's not really like is ever said, I don't think, in the New Testament or the Bible, that Jesus is actually descended from anyone other than God. I guess when you're the Son of God, you don't really need to pepper it up. Like, actually, he's the great grandnephew of King David.
Not just any God.
Okay. My favorite thing is in the Bible when they introduce a new character, they give you their whole backstory where they're like son of so and so, daughter of so and so, brother of so and so.
Used to do all the time. Do
you all of a sudden, Jesus gets dropped. It's the Son of God.
Do you know John? My son, your grandfather's son, your dad, your mother's husband.
Your cousin Michael, he had a girlfriend. His girlfriend's dad's brother's across the street neighbor, it's him. You got to know him.
I was just going to say, it was really annoying when the Bible was coming out, live, and people were waiting for the new books to come out.
Yeah.
And every time they'd introduce a new character, they'd go on this like whole side story where it was just like 5 months later, we're just learning about this guy that just showed up and how Jesus is going to be the King of Kings. And people kept saying, Jesus is never going to do it, but he did it.
Yeah. There were some plot holes, where he's supposed to be like all powerful, all knowing, but he can't figure out that he made, people who make mistakes,
Mm-hmm. True.
So he sounds also felt the I don't get it.
I also felt the Impel Down arc was kind of weak.
Yeah. I don't know what you just said.
It was a One Piece joke. I was describing the Bible as being One Piece because anytime a new character shows up in One Piece, they do like flashbacks and like backstory stuff for them, and like 3 months later they get back to the regular story. That's why One Piece is like up to 1,200 chapters, I think.
That's awesome. I mean, honestly, if you got rid of all like the family tree and like the shout out, like record producer shout outs in the Bible, you could probably whittle it down to like 300 pages. You could get through that thing in an afternoon.
Yeah, but you got to keep in the skits. The skits are what make it. If you don't have the skits in there, that's the problem with modern religious style texts.
Without skits. I mean, you wouldn't have W balls. None of that, dude.
So according to Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the legendary Holy Grail is simultaneously the womb of Saint Mary Magdalene and the sacred royal bloodline she gave birth to, which the church tried to kill off all remnants of, and their supposed guardians, who were the Cathars and the Templars. In order for the popes to hold the episcopal throne through apostolic succession without fear of it ever being usurped by an anti-pope from the hereditary succession of Mary Magdalene. We talked about the Cathars before previously. We don't know a lot about the Cathars, just that they were they're most likely Gnostic Christians.
Yeah.
Because everything we have about them is from the Catholic Church, and very much like the Druids stuff. Like, we don't really know anything about the Druids other than what the Romans told us, and the Romans hated them.
So yeah.
So the Romans just like, yeah, they practiced human sacrifice. They did all these crazy rituals, and it's just one of those things where people make claims about them, but like, you have no idea what their things were.
One thing we do know actually is that the Cathars went through some shit.
Yeah.
Well, they were all like wiped out.
They came out the other side a little bit, you know, a little bit changed. Anybody getting this joke at all?
No.
They're cathartic.
Oh my God.
They're cathartic.
All right, bro. Now I get it.
Oh man. You guys are stupid. I'm just kidding. I'm serious.
Womp womp.
I'm serious. How did you not know?
The authors therefore conclude that the modern.
Oh, by the way, it is going to be the official opinion of this show that we don't know shit about the Druids. I like the way you phrase that. Yeah. We don't know shit about the Druids.
I feel like Spaceballs when the guys comb in the desert, quote unquote. We don't know shit.
You know they killed people.
I mean, you mean it. Tuvok?
Was that sure. Tuvok?
Yeah.
No, that's amazing. I didn't know that. We ain't found shit.
Excellent scene.
So the authors conclude that the modern goals of the Priory of Sion are to make the public revelation of the tomb and shrine of Sigbert the IV, as well as the lost treasure of the temple in Jerusalem, which supposedly contains genealogical records that prove the Merovingian dynasty was of Davidic line, to facilitate the Merovingian restoration in France. The reinstitutionalization of chivalric knighthood and the promotion of pan-European nationalism.
Uh-oh.
The establishment of a theocratic United States of Europe.
Sounds a lot like the EU.
Yeah, a holy European empire politically and religiously unified through the imperial cult of a Merovingian great monarch who occupies both the throne of Europe and the Holy See. And then the actual governance of Europe residing with the Priory of Sion through a one-party European parliament.
You know, they call it the Holy See, but I've never even seen... There's no water. I mean...
The authors also incorporated the anti-Semitic and anti-Masonic tract known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion into their story, concluding that it was based on the master plan of the Priory of Sion.
Oh, boy.
They presented it as the most persuasive piece of evidence for the existence and activities of the Priory of Sion by arguing that the original text on which the published version of the Protocols of Elders of Zion was based had nothing to do with Judaism or an international Jewish conspiracy as it issued from a Masonic body practicing the Scottish Rite, which incorporated the word Zion in its name. Per the authors, the text was not intended to be released publicly, but was a program for gaining control of Freemasonry as part of a strategy to infiltrate and reorganize the church and the state according to esoteric Christian principles.
Like you do.
After a failed attempt to gain influence in the court of Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, Sergei Nihilus was supposed to have changed the original text to forge an inflammatory tract in 1903 to discredit the esoteric clique around the Pope the Papas by implying they were Judeo-Masonic conspirators, but he ignored some esoteric Christian elements, which hence remained unchanged in the published anti-Semitic work.
You're telling me his name was Sergei Nihilus?
Yeah, N-I-L-U-S.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Unlike most Eastern European people. He's actually pretty happy, you know, smiling.
I just played a sad horn sound effect. You guys can't hear it.
I heard it.
No, I mean, not you. Dude, relax. I mean our 13 listeners in Sweden.
We can sell them a soundboard that they can use.
Oh God.
We'll just drop ship out some soundboards that are cheaply made that have like a trilateral troika sticker on them.
Yeah, it'll be a YouTube video and it'll just be like a line going, and then when you're supposed to hit it, you have to hit the button. That's
amazing. You can play along at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like those old books on tape or whatever.
Hmm. What do you mean?
Like when you were a kid and you'd listen to like the tapes that would go along with the book.
Yeah.
They'd tell you like turn page now.
Yep.
Another author that also makes wild claims about the Knights Templar is one Graham Hancock. Graham Hancock usually does a lot of like ancient civilization stuff.
Yeah.
He's very popular with Joe Rogan.
Yeah, I don't get it.
So he's a dipshit then, right?
Yes.
Okay, there we go.
He's one of those, like, the pyramid is older than Egyptian society, and, like, it was made by somebody else, and, like, it has, like, water erosion on it type guy.
Gotcha. The joke is that Joe likes those things that, if you heard when you were high, would blow you away, you know?
Yeah, and as soon as you're sober, you're like, that's the dumbest fucking thing I have ever heard in my goddamn life. Makes
sense, right?
But if you're never sober, like Joe Rogan, it's always awesome.
Insane.
So Hancock claims in his book, The Sign and the Seal, The Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant, that the Templars were after the Ark of the Covenant. Hancock proposes that the Ark was removed from Solomon's temple in Jerusalem by temple priests during the reign of the evil king Manasseh of Judah around 650 BC. Then it spent around 200 years in a purpose-built temple in Elephantine Egypt.
That's a pretty big jump.
It was removed around 470 BC to Ethiopia via tributaries in the Nile River, where it was kept on the Jewish island of Tana Chirkos for about 800 more years as the center of a strong Jewish community there. Hmm. It then eventually came into the hands of the young Ethiopian Orthodox Church in the 5th century, who took it to their capital of Aksum, where it supposedly remains there to this day, in the Church of Our Lady Mary of Zion. The Ethiopian Church believes that the Ark is indeed held today in the church, but as opposed to the book, they believe that it was brought to Ethiopia by Menelik I, stolen from Solomon's temple during the reign of King Solomon himself, some 200 years earlier than the events proposed by the book.
Yeah, I know there's that one church in Ethiopia where it's like, I think that's the one you're talking about, where they think they have the Ark and they won't let people go in there.
Yeah, no, like no one's allowed to like go anywhere near it. Like you're kept a pretty.
Same thing in my house. I have the Ark, but you can't come in. See,
that's in my Ark room.
Oh my God! Did I miss something? How are the Templars involved there?
We'll get to that. This is all sort of like pre like the Crusades, like history of like
a lot of like, prologue.
He also claims that the Holy Grail and Ark of the Covenant may possibly be one and the same relic as a result of a comparative study by him of the great German epic by Wolfram von Eschenbach Parzival, the Ethiopian national epic Kebra Nagas, and the legend of Prester John, and the iconography of the Chartres Cathedral in France.
That's a lot of evidence.
Parzival is like a German sort of epic about Percival, the Knight of the Round Table, and the Kebra Nagas is like a national sort of like epic about like Ethiopia becoming like Christian. It's sort of like a mythological legendary story that that generally Ethiopians consider to be like fact, but it's also like some like Old Testament type stuff where like, you know, like probably someone in Israel will claim like the like all the stuff that's in the Old Testament happened when like most of it didn't.
Okay. Percival was a kid I just used to cheat off of in math class, so I was confused for a second.
Percy.
Hancock also claims that the Knights Templar searched for the lost Ark of the Covenant, among other relics, at the site of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem in the 12th century. It was during that time that's likely an Ethiopian king in exile, Lali Bela, who was in Jerusalem in the 12th century, made contact with the Knights Templar. This claim is supported by the legacy of architecture in the city of Lababela, built during the reign of King Lababela, of which the Church of St. George, Lababela, is of particular interest in relation to the development of Gothic architecture. So the summation is that he most likely came into contact with them because, like, in Ethiopia, in that one city, the architecture there has a more European, like, Gothic bent than what you normally see in Ethiopian architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ethiopian church, fearful of losing the Ark to the Knights Templar, sent emissaries in 1306 to Pope Clement V. The Catholic Church's fear was that the Knights Templar, in acquiring the power of the Ark of the Covenant, Hancock claims, is one of the reasons why Clement began prosecution and arrest of the Knights Templar in 1307. So it all ties into that the reason why they were killed is not because, you know, the King of France was mad at them because he owed them money. It was because, you know, they're going to get the Ark of the Covenant any moment now, and they're going to be too powerful.
Okay. That's great. Who knows what would have happened?
You know, they would have opened it up. People would have been melting.
Mm-hmm. That's what I saw last time I saw the Ark. It was in a movie, though. But it was real to me.
It doesn't matter. It's real me.
Another legendary object that's claimed that that was connected to the Templars is the Shroud of Turin.
Oh, wait. Is that the thing that Jesus was supposedly buried in?
Yeah, it's Jesus' beach towel. He used too much spray tan, and it got on a towel, and now people can see him in it.
And just to jump ahead a couple hundred years, it is fake, correct?
I mean, it is. It's probably 100% fake. Yeah.
Okay.
There's a lot of good arguments. Also, without going into like the carbon dating and stuff of like why it would be fake, okay. In terms of like how the imprint is done and how like an imprint wouldn't normally be done like that. It's almost like one of those things where like it's not done in a fashion of like how it would naturally occur, but in a fashion that like somebody who wanted to say it occurred would do it, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
See, all these like relics turning out to be fake. That's why the Protestant Church started, you know, because they had all these cool like items with abilities and stuff, but then they all turned out to be just fake, and they lost interest.
Oh, is that why?
It wasn't because there were enough pieces of the true cross lying around to build a castle.
There was no true cross.
It wasn't because there was a king that wanted to like divorce his wife and fuck somebody else.
No, that was just the story they made up. The reality was,
dude, I remember I had to be like 18 when I found that out. Like that was like the history of Protestantism, and I was like, I'm sorry, what?
That's Protestantism in England.
It's part of it. Martin Luther's
which we talked about too. Like it's just them being pissed off at like the Catholic Church's like excesses, and then Martin Luther was also kind of like crazy in that like he also was like he's like, well, now that we've done away with the church, we could have things like polygamy, and then the princes and then the princes and kings were like, no, we'll just stick with the
Vicar, not having the Pope.
He's like, no, baby steps.
Why can't I have two lady?
Martin Luther did the full cult leader progression where he's just like, God has told me that I am to have multiple wives.
I have added an 11th commandment, thou shalt rock out with thine cock out. Thank you.
So the shroud was first publicly displayed in 1357 by the widow of a nobleman named Geoffrey of Charnay. It was described by some sources who was described by some sources as being a member of the family of the grandson of Geoffroy de Charnay, who was burned at the stake with de Molay.
Jockey boy.
In 2009, Barbara Frail, a paleographer in the Vatican Secret Archives, claimed that the Shroud of Turin had been kept by the Templars after 1204. She claimed that the quote-unquote burial certificate of Jesus the Nazarene was imprinted in fragments of Greek, Hebrew, and Latin writing and is visible on the shroud. And also, the temple comb painting, a painting discovered in 1945 by Molly Drew in the roof of an outhouse of a cottage in Temple Combe, England, has been alleged to be a copy of the image on the Turin Shroud, and therefore evidence of the Turin Shroud being in the possession of the Knights Templar during its quote-unquote hidden years. The painting has been on display in St. Mary's Church in the village since 1956, which is the only Templar-related site to have survived there, and has been carbon dated to about 1280 AD. Some people believe that it is a Templar commissioned image of either Jesus Christ or the severed head of John the Baptist, although it is without a halo.
Hmm. Okay.
And there are a number of sort of like, because like I said, like when the Templars got taken out, it was like if like Wells Fargo, as we discussed, got taken out.
Yeah.
Where like there was like used to be a Pizza Hut type situations. Where they're like buildings are like, oh yeah, that used to be the Templar Castle, or that used to be like the Templar Bank.
Like if Scientology falls and
their
like,
money back?
And like Walmart moves into that building, you're like, oh, that's the old Scientology building because it's very distinctive.
Right. It's well, like, you know, it's like a pizza, like a freestanding Pizza Hut, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. you could spot those a million miles away. That's not a gynecologist. I tell you, they had some other bread growing there. Some pizza bread.
For instance, like the Temple District in London, that is called that because that's where the Templar Bank was.
Oh, okay.
Interesting.
And there's still some standing structures there that used to be the Templar buildings. But again, like a lot of that's been lost because, you know, the Templars haven't been in them in like 800 years.
Yeah. Plus the British are thieves largely and they stole all of it. So.
Yes. another conspiracy theory about the Templars is the curse of de Molay.
Uh-oh.
All right, Jacques.
The author Malcolm Barber in 2006 discussed a supposed curse uttered by the last Grand Master of the Templar Order, Jacques de Molay, as he was burned at the stake in 1314. He supposedly cursed King Philip IV of France and Pope Clement V by saying that he would meet them before God before the year was out. As mentioned in the previous episode, Clement died only a month later, and King Philip died later that year in a hunting accident.
Mm-hmm.
and going even further, within a short number of years afterwards, Philip's sons died at relatively young ages, resulting in the end of the House of Capet. Leading to disputes over succession and the Hundred Years' War as different factions battled for the throne. Barber traces the story to a verse chronicle attributed to Geoffrey of Paris, the La Chronique Metrique attribuée à Geoffrey de Paris.
Wow.
And Geoffrey of Paris was, quote unquote, apparently an eyewitness who describes Molay as showing no sign of fear and significantly as telling those present that God would avenge their deaths.
Ah, God's got you guys. It's fine.
Just leave it in his hands. He got
yeah, you're good.
Jesus, take the wheel.
Exactly.
And kill these
dudes. Why do they say that? There was no cars around when Jesus was around. He wouldn't know what the fuck to do. He gave a steering wheel. He'd shit his pants.
Right, exactly.
He would just crash the car. Wait,
which one's the gas pedal? And everyone dies.
It's like the thing of like taking like George Washington dropping in the middle of like Times Square today, and it's just him screaming for an hour.
Jesus causes a 37 car pileup on I-75, and he's like, "Well, I might have come back a little bit too soon." Ben just snaps his fingers; he's gone again.
I like George Washington. Just in the calm light of a mild philosophy. In the calm light of a mild philosophy. What the fuck is CVS?
He sees the M&M store and he just starts, he just has a breakdown like a Lovecraft character.
He can't find where, I need a crucifix. Where are they? Why is this place closed? It's Sunday.
A commentator, Albert Pike, claimed that the
Albert fucking Pike. Here we go.
Why do I know that name?
Very, very famous figure in Southern Freemasonry.
Okay. Yeah. He claimed that the knight Kadosh, the 30th degree within the ancient accepted and Scottish Rite, commonly known as a vengeance degree, involved the trampling on the papal tiara and the royal crown, destined to wreak a just vengeance on the high criminals for the murder of de Molay.
I'd say the two most popular Masons, well, this isn't true, but popular as being involved with like Masonic secrecy are Albert Pike and Manly P. Hall. Those two. Yeah. Manly P. Hall is interesting. He wrote, what is it? The Secrets of All the Ages or something like that. I read the whole fucking thing. It's ridiculous. You can't even follow it. There's too much.
Yeah.
There's a series of mid 20th century novels, Leroy Maudit's The Accursed Kings by Maurice Druon, which was first published in 1955, expanded on the story of the curse of Molay and the French monarchy in the 14th century.
I mean, it's the 14th century. I mean, you could die just like, oh, the weather took a turn and you're dead, you know? I mean, you get like a sniffle and it turns into full-blown death, you know?
Where he attributes his last words to cursed, you'll all be cursed. You'll be all cursed until the 13th generation of your races will have disappeared.
Oh, so they. So now they're churching this curse up. So now it's not just the two guys that died. Now it's like their fucking successive generations and shit.
Yeah.
Yes, and then this also goes into a popular version of the legend, which attributes the death of Henry the 16th. Saying he belonged to the 13th generation after Philip IV. But in reality, the 13th generation is, in fact, Louis the 14th's children.
Huh.
Hmm.
And also another frequent recurring legend relates how when Louis the 16th was guillotined, an anonymous French Freemason rushed from the crowd, dipping his hand in the king's blood, or grabbed the head and held it, or is just heard in the crowd and yelled, Jacques de Molay, thou art avenged.
Hmm.
Okay.
That really, like, escalated. I mean, from, like, in reverse, though, right? Like, he's just yelling from the crowd like he's at a Mets game, or he's dipping his hand in the king's blood?
That's,
yeah. Or he's holding his head up?
Yeah, because it's like some Assassin's Creed level like stuff where they're like positing, you know, that the Templars and the Assassins are sort of like warring with each other secretly throughout like human history.
It's true. It's a true story.
There's also theories that the Templars survived and sub even possibly to this day.
Is it any sort of factual basis to that whatsoever?
Well, We talked about they did. They existed in like Portugal. Remember, it was like the less sexy version of the legend is they just went to Portugal and, you know, like helped with colonialism and then eventually just became another like useless knightly order.
Hmm.
Or like it's just essentially a medal you get and then a title that you can't transfer to your children.
Yeah. Okay.
For instance, as for mentioned, some authors and historians try to draw a link from Freemasonry to the Templars. As mentioned before, the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite, such as the Knight of St. Andrew, the Knight of the Rose Croix, and the 32nd degree in Consistory, make reference to a quote-unquote Masonic Knights Templar connection, but this is usually seen as just being ceremonial and not historical fact.
from what I know of it, from, you know, reading and just my brother. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, they were cool dudes. Let's just name this thing after them and, like, borrow their imagery.
Right.
The author John J. Robison argues that the Templar Masonic connection in his book Born in Blood, The Lost Secrets of Freemasonry, in which he alleges that some French Templars fled to Scotland after the suppression of the order, fearing persecution from both church and state. He claims that they sought refuge with a lodge of Scottish stonemasons, within which they began to teach the virtues of chivalry and obedience, using the builder's tools as a metaphor, and they began eventually taking in quote-unquote speculative masons, men of other professions, in order to ensure the continuation of the order. So essentially saying that, like, this is some weird, like, they like, I don't know, like, last samurai themselves into Scottish society, and then they're, like, they're teaching the Scottish how to, like, you know, be chivalrous to the Scottish. Just like, oh, this is how you make a stone block.
That does not sound like a Scot.
Nope.
I don't even know if I could do a Scottish. Ugh, you sound like a stone. No, I can't do it.
Nope, I wouldn't even try, honestly.
It's hard. You can either do Irish, English, Australian, but you can't do Scottish at the same time. No way.
Yeah.
I feel like Scottish is very, like... what's it? No, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't think it's guttural is the word I'm looking for, but it's like it comes from like the back of the throat.
Yeah,
it comes from like the back of the throat. Scottish.
It's
does.
Very Scottish.
No. According to Robinson, the order existed in secret in this
what
form.
What was that? Until what was that directed at?
Well, you said it was very Scottish, oh, the way okay. the Scottish oh, are. And I said, nah, I don't think so.
Okay.
According to Robinson, the order existed in secret in this form until the formation of the United Grand Lodge of England in 1717. Mm. An example of the transitory symbolism can be found in the Roslyn Chapel, owned by the first Earls of Roslyn, a family with well-documented ties to Scottish Freemasonry, although Roslyn Chapel itself dates from at least 100 years after the suppression of the Templars.
That's crazy.
Similar claims are also made in Michael Bajent and Richard Lay's book, who were other authors of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, The Temple and the Lodge. However, historians Mark Oxbrow, Ian Robertson, Karen Rawls, and Louise Eomen have each made it clear that the Sinclair family had no connection with the medieval Knights Templar.
So they're just basically just using the name?
They're associating them with them, but they didn't actually have a connection.
Okay.
The Sinclair's testimony against the Knights in their 1309 trial is not consistent with any alleged support or membership. So they're just saying that the thing that's said about them is just made up. They can't really verify it.
They're just
it.
Funning.
And Templars in the Grail by Karen Rawls states that among some 50 who testified against the Templars were Henry and William Sinclair. But again, the historical record, it doesn't really go with this. And going too with what was said previously, Scotland is said to be where the Templars ended up, not, you know, Portugal, where they actually were allowed to, like, keep existing. Since the 1980s, there's been a growing body of publications in both popular fiction and pseudo-history, which construct a continuity between the historical presence of the Knights Templar in Scotland with the emergence of the Masonic Scottish Knights Templar in the early modern period. This association with Roslyn Chapel originates in the 1982 book The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, and entered mainstream pop culture with The Da Vinci Code.
Dude, that was such a good book, man. And I hated it because I knew the whole time it was fake, but it was such a good fucking book to read.
Dan Brown? Yeah, he knows what he's doing, man.
Oh, he hooked me. He got his dude, shitty little claws into me. I read the whole fucking thing in like a day and a half.
Yep.
After the popularity of the book and subsequent movie, numerous books were published that sort of went on in the supposed connections between Rosalind Chapel, Freemasonry, the Templars, and the Holy Grail. There's also a tale of a missing Templar fleet, and it is supposedly based on the protocol of the interrogation of one Jean de Chalon by the Inquisition. He claimed that he had heard that the preceptor of the French Templars, Gerard de Villiers, he had decided that they would all go to Russia in order to escape the accusations against them.
That sounds like a Gerard Depardieu movie.
That they had been warned of his imminent arrest. De Villiers had escaped with 50 horses and 18 galleys, and de Chalon's son, Hugh de Chalon, escaped with him carrying the wealth of his uncle, Hugh de Perrault. In Baijin, in ways, the temple and the lodge, the fleet carried the treasure of the Paris preceptory of the Templars.
Mm-hmm.
Scotland became the destination of the fleet, and over four centuries later, in the claims of George Frederick Johnson, an exiled Jacobite living in Austria. Johnson, though, however, turned out to be a fraud, who was probably called Johann Samuel Luchte. And after a checkered career based on alchemy and forgery, Johnson convinced a Masonic lodge in Jena that he possessed the highest secrets of masonry, and having declared the rest of German masonry irregular, brought a surprising amount of lodges under his control.
Yeah, I know some good shit. Great.
Well, he essentially did what like Crowley did with like the Golden Dawn.
Yeah.
Where he just like shows up and then he knows it's all just like weird sex stuff.
Yeah.
And then they're like, it's like, yeah, this guy knows the good magic.
He's got that good stuff. Look at all these sluts.
He discovered the prostate and they acted like it was some arcane wisdom.
Listen, what you want to do is you want to hook your pinky. No, why would you use your middle finger?
He would, Johnson.
You gotta work up to that. That's the 33rd degree.
Johnson was exposed as a fraud by a Karl Gotthelf von Hund in 1764, and he was later apprehended by a previous victim and spent the rest of his life in prison.
I just want to say, I knew his name did not end with just Carl and then a last name. I knew that I had this inclination you were going to say von fucking something, and you did.
Hun's initial attraction to Johnson was spurred by a need to find his own superiors. He had been received into the Order of the Temple by high-ranking Jacobites in Paris during 1743, and being introduced to Charles Edward Stuart himself. After the failure of the 1745 rebellion, his masters were either in hiding or dead, and he had lost interest in maintaining their Templar offshoots, leaving Hund with a depleted ritual book, which he had to reconstruct from memory. As Johnson's collection of lodges now looked for him for leadership, the Rite of Strict Observance was born. Again, the foundation myth alleged that Freemasonry was started by Templar refugees under the protection of Robert the Bruce, who was a king of Scotland.
Yeah, Robert the Bruce, man. He was in Braveheart.
Yeah.
He was.
Are you for real?
Yeah.
All right, then I retract my little giggles.
No, you can have them. That's fine.
This time they had traveled from France through England, disguised as stonemasons, and their use of Masonic symbols in their allegories paid tribute to this deception. Under Hun's leadership...
So at the time, if like you got pulled over and you said you were a Mason, and you were about to get capped, you know, because you said you were a Mason, they didn't like Masons, and you said, oh, I'm a stonemason. Did you have to like prove you could Mason stone? Like,
all right, he's a block. Carve my sister's face into it. Go. Yeah,
carve it.
Yeah. The police had like a wagon with like a giant stone block on it.
Dovetail the edges.
It's like,
dovetail,
show us what you got, Mr. Fancy Pants.
Yeah. Dovetail these edges right now.
Venus de Milo, go.
I want to see some nice abs in the stone. But under Hun's leadership, the Rite of Strict Observance became the most popular branch of Freemasonry in the German states, with lodges all over continental Europe. However, his continued inability to produce or even contact his quote-unquote unknown superiors led to increasing dissatisfaction. 6 years after his death, a convent meeting in Wilhelmsbad from 1782 to 1783 finally agreed that Freemasonry had no connection to the Templars and strict observance ceased to exist, most lodges being absorbed into the rectified Scottish Rite. For most of the previous two decades, the most common foundation myth among German Masons stated that Freemasonry came from the Knights Templar, protected and allowed to flourish in Scotland. In 1815, Claude Thory, a respected French scientist and Freemason, claimed that Robert the Bruce had created the Order of St. Andrew for Masons who had supported him at Bannockburn, which was later joined to the Order of Hairdom, which he founded at Kilwinny.
Order of Hairdom?
Yeah.
Like,
or Hairdom.
Oh, Hairdom. Okay, that was the Order of Hairdom.
Order of like Hairdom.
From the Kingdom of Great Clips.
The Great Clipian Dynasty.
My order of supercuts.
That's not a real order, Steve. That was made up and inserted into the French library.
His name is John the Barber from the Supercuts Order from the Land of Great Clips.
It's Final Scion, Brutus the Barber Beefcake.
He would make a good William Wallace, you know?
Brother Broody in his heyday.
Yeah.
When Hogan just made him look like a clone of him.
Oh my god.
When he gets introduced to WCW as Brother Broody. In 1837... a Scottish Freemason, James Burns, in attempting to revive the Scottish Order of Knights Templar, expanded the Masonic link to Bannockburn. He introduced the Knights Templar as the bearers on Freemasonry to Scotland and had the Templars play a crucial part in the battle. This appears to be the basis of subsequent tales of Templar involvement at Bannockburn. The contemporary Royal Order of Scotland makes use of a similar foundation myth, which is no more intended to be taken as historical fact than any other piece of Masonic allegory. Going on this as well, there's also theories that the Freemasons actually discovered America.
Yeah, here story. We go.
In Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
We're starting off good. Go ahead.
With the aforementioned Lost Fleet that we discussed, it alleges that the Templars in these ships, quote-unquote, fled to the New World by following old Viking routes.
Of course.
Wait a minute. That right there insinuates that they didn't discover jack shit that the Vikings did.
Well, the Vikings didn't know they were in America.
It doesn't matter. Even if you don't know, you still discovered it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, motherfucker, of course you did. Just because you didn't know. I mean, it just makes you not like understanding what you found. You know what I'm saying?
Well, regardless, it's speculation that they went to the Americas well before like Columbus.
How's this? 5,000 years ago, somebody found gold. They didn't know what the fuck they found, but they're like, oh, this is shiny, this is cool. They didn't realize what they found, but they are still technically the one who discovered it.
Okay, Ryan, we all know about Johnny Gold and how he discovered gold, okay?
Yeah. Is it Johnny Gold? I thought Johnny Gold was his cousin.
No, you're thinking of Bobby Gold.
Oh, Bobby Gold, right, yeah.
Bobby Gold, Jimothy's cousin.
Jimothy, yeah.
And this is sort of been alluded to in popular culture, such as in the movie National Treasure, where there's a supposed Templar treasure in New York City.
Oh, word? Where at?
I forget exactly where it was. I haven't seen National Treasure in, like, several decades.
Oh, okay.
As early as 2001, historian Helen Nicholson, in A Popular History of the Templars, dispels the idea that the Templars could, quote-unquote, spare ships to indulge in world exploration. In the book The Templar Code for Dummies in 2007, it also points out the historical implausibility of this scenario. In the book, it states, as for having 18 galleys that may have left for La Rochelle, history doesn't back that up. In shipping records from La Rochelle of the period, there is no record that the Templars had 18 galleys, much less that 18 galleys were at La Rochelle. Reports in the years leading up to the arrest seem to imply that the Templars, and the Hospitallers for that matter, actually had very few large ships. Some suggest no more than 4, and hired more from merchant shippers when needed.
We don't know much about the Hospitallers, just like the Cathars. All we know is that if you needed their services, it was real expensive, like right up front.
Yeah, you know, like you go to Malta and they just, you know, they charge you an arm and a leg for everything.
Yeah, they charge you an arm and a leg for your arm and your leg.
And as mentioned in the previous episode, that the finding of the Chenon letter in September 11th, 2001, it's also been asserted by conspiracy theorist Richard Hoagland of who we have previously talked about. In his article, the Twin Towers of the Great Masonic Experiment, has the end of days begun?
Oh God!
Jesus Christ!
Hoagland applies esoteric numerology in his theory that the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001 were carried out by the Order of Assassins against the Knights Templar.
This guy. Fucking guy.
Michael Barkin, professor emeritus of political science at Syracuse University, summarized and discussed Hoagland's 9/11 Templar conspiracy theory in his article, A Culture of Conspiracy, Apocalyptic Visions in Contemporary America, I should say, his work. He states, each World Trade Center had 110 floors, which is a multiple of 11. One of them was struck by Flight 11, which had 11 crew members and so on. The Order of the Knights Templar was recognized by the Vatican in the year 1118, whose integers add up to 11. There are 883 years between the date of 2001 and the sum of those numbers, 19, is the same as the number of hijackers. The number 19 allowed Hoagland to introduce the Quranic numerology of Rashad Khalifa, in which it is central. By the time Hoagland finished, the events of September 11th were revealed to be an attack by none other than the Islamic Order of Assassins on the Knights Templar and the Masons.
Ugh, dude, he lost the plot, man.
Yeah, he was lost in the sauce.
Well, I mean, he did get sued by Ubisoft for spoiling, you know, Assassin's Creed 7.
Oh my god.
It's like, is there a way for them both to lose? I don't know.
It's kind of funny too that the Assassins or Hashishans get brought up in the same way when they did even less than the Templars.
Hashishans, that's just where you buy drugs from. Pretty sure his name was Amir, so I need you to, you know, use his name correctly.
He's a good guy.
Put some respect on my boy's name.
He used to dip his cigarettes in hash oil and smoke them, and that dude used to be—he had to be just cooked every single time I went over there.
Oh my god,
Rush. Okay, listen. Okay, side. He was like, I want to say he was like Persian, had like the big chest hair, always had a gold chain on. Dude smoked cigarettes constantly, unfiltered, and I want to say they were like Turkish cigarettes. And he would dip them in hash oil, and I would literally just be there to just buy weed from this guy. And he was the nicest guy I've ever met in my life. But dude, I tried that one time. I dipped like a camel into some hash oil and tried smoking it, and I was fucked for like 3 hours. So to see this guy smoke him, like chain smoke him like that, I'm like, dude, there's no way.
Do you want me to mute this gone. Story about your connect?
No, I don't give a shit. This is years ago. This was like, this was at least.
Don't say the year.
No, this was at least 15 years ago, man. It's a long time.
Oh my god, I just said the year.
No, like 15 years ago.
Okay, so could be. Maybe not, officer.
Maybe not. Might be 14. Who knows?
I think there's also a statute of limitation.
I think it's a statute of limitation, and I'm honestly in the year of our Lord 2024. I don't think there is a detective in the United States of America who's gonna be like, I need to find out who Amir is.
Yeah, take I'm just down. Saying. You never know. I mean, yeah.
Might be
connect.
Might be the local DARE officer. You know, he's they're bringing it back. Retro.
I heard DARE took weed out of the curriculum though.
I watched the thing where they interviewed like people at the DARE conference, and they're of the mindset that like anything is like bad. Like which obviously it is, but just like they're like, well, like DARE officer's like, well, I don't even drink.
Yep.
Dude, shut the fuck. Shut up. Yes, you do. Stop lying. God damn it. Lying.
I mean, some people just come on here to say don't. Anything.
A cop.
Yeah.
No. I have never met a cop who is not a drinker. Even one or two after work. I'm not saying you're like some heavy alcoholic who's just like DUIing all over the place.
I know one or two that don't drink.
Mm-mm.
Or like at least not a lot.
That's what I'm saying. But I mean, they'll at least have a couple every now and then.
Yeah.
Special occasions, whatever.
Yep.
And on that note, watch out for Assassin.
Oh,
and Richard Hoagland.
And Ryan's Connect from about 15 years ago, who might be an assassin.
Might have been 14 years ago. Who knows?
Yeah, it could have been 13, too.
Amir, if you're listening, I appreciate the hookup all the time, man.
Ryan used to go up to Alamut. He would climb the mountain. He would go in there. He would go to buy his bids, and then he'd have to talk to me.
This was shit weed. It was not even good. That's the worst. It was fucking.
He'd buy his ditch weed. He'd have to sit
in the gutter.
He'd have to sit in the garden of Alamut, the eagle's nest, while the guy just talked about how much he loved friends, and then wait for it to get to a point where he could just get it and leave.
I do not think the Courtney Cox is very good. She was good, but then she became Courtney Cox Arquette and no longer good.
Bro, I was like a teenager. I didn't know what was good and what was bad weed. He's like, oh, yes, it's good shit. It's good shit. It's good shit. Yes. 10-4-5. Yes, fine. Yeah, come on.
Oh, my God. All right.
Well,
on that note, don't become a bank for the church. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Are you ready, sir?
Broncos country. Let's ride.
You motherfucker.